Okay, hi, Sandra.
Hello.
I'd like to speak a bit about system theory. By necessity, that would be a bit of a one-sided conversation, a bit of a storytelling, for the simple reason that system theory is all about connectedness and interconnectedness. In my mind, it is the Swiss pocket knife of science, or even the Swiss pocket knife of mind and biology and the body. And that's also how it was conceived. System theory, written in the book called General System Theory, is the development of an idea by a biologist, Ludwig von Bertalanffy. And his idea of system theory was so effective that it has been taken in into all branches of science, even though they forget it and ignore it and might even deny it because they gave it different names. So once you understand system theory and where it came from, you can recognize it basically everywhere. And for me, that was also what made system theory conferences so interesting, because there would be architects, biologists, artists, scientists, mathematicians, physicists, biologists, basically anybody in any field of interest coming together, talking about what they were doing, what they were finding, but they would always be referring to this model of system theory, as a result of which everybody could recognize the underlying model and discover how this time you could see how it at work in how the Sufis make their tapestries, or how a boat can sail with the wind, and so on. Ludwig von Bertalanffy, as a biologist, at some point realized that in mathematics people were getting somewhere, so to say. There was a time when people were just calculating the size of the land with geometry and the amount of harvest with algebra, all for the purpose of taxation as used in old Egypt. And over the years, this language of calculated behavior changed. And so in Babylon, they started to use this kind of notation for the shipping trade. Essentially, the banking system came out of that. But they also realized that there were very specific qualities to numbers, and especially something interesting when you could connect numbers to movement of matter. So that is where Isaac Newton, at some point started to realize that with this mathematics you could have a better understanding of how the world of physics works. And that was the time that physics, and later chemistry, was essentially replaced by mathematics. It was no longer our description of how things can be seen in physics, or the formulation of how things relate to each other in chemistry, but that was something much more fundamental, that it is possible to describe how things transform. So essentially that's where in science they moved from matter to molecules to atoms. When they moved from physics to chemistry to electromagnetism. But in every case they were able to use mathematics. And one of the reasons why they were still being able to use mathematics was that they changed the laws of mathematics. Evidently, because there are no laws of mathematics. Mathematics are ideas which we have about how we choose to represent something and model it in our mind. And just like we are free to point at anything and shout, making whichever noise out of which came the understanding of words, likewise we can look at something and use any symbol to in our mind anchor that idea. That's an interesting topic in itself, how we actually create language, and that's a topic which I call languaging. And mathematics is an instance of that, it's an example of that. So in mathematics you're free to look at anything or have anything in your mind and denote it by a symbol. Actually, that is originally called symbolic magic. So surprisingly enough, you can see that over the course of the ages, the art and the act of magic has become integrated and unified within science. Evidently, the scientists don't want to look at it that way, and they can't see it that way because the Inquisition told them that that's not allowed. But the Inquisition has changed. Well, in fact, it only changed its name. Now the principles of magic are very much in use. So you have creational magic, you have symbolic magic, you have Egyptian magic, and a couple of other forms. Basically, they all relate to the way that you can manipulate ideas separate from the reality that we're in, which means that we can see in magic or in mathematics how we work with ideas. So the most important thing is that in mathematics we can have a musical script of the choreography of the dance of our mind, and you can use any form of symbol notation. So astrology, for example, uses a system of cycles within cycles within cycles to see how periodicity, cyclicity, and time fields relate. Tarot, or tarot, as some call it, is the notation in symbols of the way relationships are possible. And that is, in fact, a description of alchemy elaborated in connecting up the solid state of things, the liquid state of things, the gaseous state of things, and the plasma state of things, which was the topic of the previous exploration. And so in mathematics you can do that too. And mathematics has developed very many different branches of symbolic notations, and you really need to know what people had in mind when they described them to be able to understand what you can do with it. So it is literally a language for the mind, a bit like the music for an organ. Once you read the lines on the paper in your mind, you can set things in motion, which will be very similar to what was taking place in the mind of somebody else when they wrote down those symbols. So having this general and broad understanding of the purpose and the principle of mathematics, let's now connect that to the way mathematics had developed by the work of Newton and Leibniz and many others around that time, when they started to realize that it was possible to describe things as they are, but it is also possible to describe things as they change. And that is a very neat and tricky idea of Leibniz and Newton and some others around that time. In fact, Archimedes already had a graphic description of doing that, which is that if you look at something, for example, if you throw an apple up in the air, then you can see that it goes up in the air, but somehow it slows down. Then for a moment it seems to hang there, and then it comes down again until it very quickly falls. And this was then realized to be a specific curve, which they call the parabola. And this parabolic curve, as you would see it with jugglers throwing apples from one hand to the other, of course beg the question of how can you understand what's happening, specifically because they knew what a circle was. You have a piece of string and a bit of pencil, and you push one end of the string on a paper or anywhere, you can draw a circle. But this was a different kind of curve. So they started to realize that a curve like that, a parabola, or if you look at it from another perspective, it will be a hyperbola, is something which you will see when you look at a cone shape. If you cut it horizontally, the top surface that you will see will be a circle, but if you cut it sideways, you would probably see an ellipse or a parabola and hyperbola. So they realized that these shapes were related, but they weren't quite sure how to work that. So then the mathematics was brought in, which said, okay, we cannot see the whole thing as it happens, but what if we look at just little bits of it? So instead of looking at the whole journey from point A to point B and trying to determine how fast the chariot will be going going from London to Oxford, then what happens if we look into the details of it? And then we can see that at some point the chariot will be going at a quite steady pace on the King's Road, but at some point it goes up the bridge, it goes slower until it is on top of the bridge, then it sort of can go faster again, and then when it goes down the bridge it goes much faster again until it's at the bottom of the bridge again. So they started to cut up these travel sectors of the part before the bridge, the part going up the bridge, the part on top of the bridge, the part going down the bridge, and these different segments of the journey were then called differentials. And so a mathematics came out of that, in which they were able to zoom in on those differentials and actually turn something which is curved into something which looks straight. Just if you have a circle, so for example a woman might be wearing a bracelet, if she looks at it from a distance it will look at a circle, but the closer you bring it to the eye, when you look at the rim, the more it starts to look like a straight line. So mathematics had done that. They had gone into this technology, this technique of differentials, and they were also able to compare differentials of different kinds. So for example, they could look at the chariot traveling on the road, but in the same way they could look at the wheel turning on the road, or they could look at the axle going up and down on the road, or maybe on the other side of the spring, how the chariot moves up and down on the road. So as a result, they were able to look at quite complex systems described in what's then called these differential equations. And so that led to a form of mathematics which was defined by a system of differential equations, and that's where the concept of system theory comes from. Ludwig von Bertalanffy realized that when people have these systems of equations, and many people nowadays learn that in school, so they have the algebraic equations of a times x plus b times y plus c times z equals d times t, for example, and then they can have a series of those equations one under each other, as a result of which they can analyze quite complex systems. So Ludwig von Bertalanffy realized that there was something fundamental about that set, that system of equations, because it started to approximate the kind of complexity that he was looking at in biology. And his book is an interesting read. It is very simple to understand in general, and the mathematics is just the handle that he uses to communicate with the people in that field to see how his ideas can be formulated in that form of mathematics. More fundamental in his approach is that he in a way rediscovered alchemy, which is what we addressed the previous time. He realized that when you have these differential equations, that you can describe states But you can also see that the states change and that you then have processes. You can also see that these processes can change within themselves, so that you have a change of a change, which is called a transformation. And by the terminology of Arthur M. Young later, you can even look at the change of the change of the change and see that there things get really interesting, because sometimes it will fall apart, sometimes it will repeat itself. And that's what Jung then described, the level of integration. So most people learn about this in school. They learn that you can look at, say, that chariot on the road and say, well, this is the position. Then you can look at that same chariot on that same road a bit later, and you can see if it is in the same position or if it has changed position. So if it is in the same position, you then have the state which is preserved, so the position remains the same. And if it is somewhere else, you know that there is a change, a variation, that's a velocity. So in that way then you can connect the position to the velocity, to the acceleration, to the coordination of something, which is the parallel of the previous exploration of the state of Earth, the process of the water element, the transformation of the air element, and the coordination of the fire element. So that means that suddenly everything that the alchemist described can now be described in terms of this mathematics of the differential equations. And this idea was so powerful that it has been used everywhere, because all that you need to do is to look for the relationship between what is the same from one picture to the other. And you look at the next level, what is the change, what is the variation, what is the process that we see? And then one deeper level, can we see how the processes connect from one picture to the other? Can we understand the transformation that is there? And at the yet deeper level, when we look at these transformations, can we see some things that will actually continue or discontinue? That is the level of the integration or disintegration. So everything alchemy has comes back in system theory, but now in such a way that you can describe it in this language of mathematics. But that makes it possible to suddenly look at very different things with the same model, with the same eye of the system scientist. So, for example, you can look at a river, and in the river you can see that there are lakes, which are these storage capacities. You can also see that there are rivers, you can also see that there are watersheds or tidal regions, and you can see that there are things like the ocean and the clouds and the rain. But in the same way, you can also look at somebody hoisting materials in and out of a house or in and out of a ship at a harbor, and then you can see that there are weights, that there are pulleys, that there are cranes, and that there are operators of the cranes. In the same way, you can also look at electronic circuits and then see that there are storage elements, which are called the condensers or the capacitors, that there are attenuation instruments, which makes it possible to change the rate of flow, which are called the coil. You can also see that there are transforming elements, which would be called the transistor or the transformer. And you can also see that there are positions where things change, yes or no. You would call that the switches. So that meant that in system theory, there was not just the knowledge of the alchemists which came back, which the previous explorations sort of pointed out how nice and simple all of that is, But suddenly that knowledge of the alchemist was rewritten using this language of the systems of differential equations, which were seen to apply to all kinds of things. So not just the harbors or the cranes in the harbors or the engines of the harbors or the machinist in the harbors. In every case you could use that same model and come to understand that by that same model basically everything we see can be described. The most powerful, however, is that in that model you can use the terminology which is known from the design of radio circuits. What I mentioned, you have the capacitor, you have the coil, you have the resistor, and you have the switch. And that graphic language, which is used in radio design, in television design, in radar design, in computer design, everything electric can be modeled in that language of the radio diagram, as it is called. So now suddenly we can see that the language of the radio diagram, which is very well known, extensively used, is actually a form of mathematics of which the rules and the principles are very well known, and it applies to everything that we know. So that is how I came to know about this, which was very interesting, because at that time I was in engineering school. While sitting at my desk, I had a vision, an image of how the universe was created. Simply, I was looking for an answer to the question, how did it all start? Where does it all come from? Essentially, the picture I saw, I can best describe as if somebody was overturning a bucket, which was not a bucket, with water, which was not water, in a space, which was not a space. And then I could see that it was that flow dynamic, which is the story of the vortex, which is the story in itself, is the basis, the foundation of all of creation. I already had that notion. Then at that time I had also been reading up on, say, the books of alchemy, for the simple reason that I was looking for ways to describe what I had been finding. And I realized that the formulation I used for that, which is a logic of yes, no, maybe, and I don't know, was seen in very many different cultures. I came up with that logic for the simple reason that if you have something suddenly coming into nothing, then there is a change from one state to the other, which means that somehow there must be a boundary between what was before and what comes after. But that means that the fundamental foundation of change is that there is a boundary, which of course has two different ways of looking at it. One is that the boundary emerges and disappears, which you call the principle of generator, operation and destruction of boundaries. So it's the essence of the God principle. But you can also see that the same takes place when something crosses the boundary. First it is on the one side of the boundary, and then a moment later it goes into the boundary, and then a moment later it's on the other side of the boundary, and suddenly it is in that domain where you're looking at it. So something emerging, a boundary emerging out of nothing, or something crossing a boundary which you cannot see, is actually the same process. So I realized that I could describe that in terms of and now you see it, now you don't. But also, if you're looking in the boundary, which separates the what you see and what you don't, then you can see that what you don't see turns into what you can see. So on the one side of the boundary you will call it, I don't see it, that's a no. On the other side of the boundary you can see, say, I can see this, that's a yes. But while you're in the boundaries, you see it emerge or you see it disappear. So it's and yes and no. So across a boundary, then you have the yes, the and yes and no, and on the other side the yes. But underlying of that all, you also have the not yes and not no, because evidently if there is a boundary which is and yes and no, which connects but at the same time separates what we could call the yes and what we could call the no on either side of the boundary, then there must be something else which we cannot see but which definitely is there, the not yes and the not no. So I had already realized the fundamental principle of creation, which in antiquity is called the God principle, generator, operate, destruction, which I later changed into the notion of the I-God principle, because you need to integrate that concept of generate, operate and destroy. So I realized that a boundary is defined by these four terms of integrating, generating, operating and destruction, which is the essence of the boundary. So for me, to look at the boundary or to look at that four-dimensional logic is the same. But that four-dimensional logic I recognized in alchemy, and I recognized that in system theory. System theory was something that was introduced in my engineering training in school as part of a development of ideas. The notion is that if you want to build a bridge or something, you can make a model of it. You can just make a little bridge and see how that works, and then if the brook get larger, you use more planks and build a larger bridge. At some point you can actually draw the bridge and in your mind put the planks in place and in your mind have understanding of how long the planks can be and when they start to bend too much to be able to use, because you would actually start to walk through the river again because the plank bends down too much. So that led to the realization that if you can build a bridge in planks, you might also build it in rocks. The Romans already got the hang of that. Actually, it is the hang upside down, because it is the same shape as what you would have if you let a chain hang. But when you turn it upside down, suddenly the rocks will support and reinforce each other, so that the shape of the bridge is the opposite of the shape of the hanging of the chain. But as a result, the flow of force, which you can easily see in the way the chain hangs, is seen back as the force flow that upholds the bridge when you build it out of the rocks. So people realized that it was possible to build bridges or build chariots or build boats and to in your mind design that and make it larger. And of course making larger is in a way crossing a boundary or extending a boundary, because the limit of it is no longer where it was before, so you move the boundary. And in moving the boundary, they realize that sometimes the game rules seem to change. For example, if you have a little boat in the bathtub and you play with that, then you can see how that little boat in the bathtub relates to a rowboat which you might use to go out on the lake, which might be similar to a barge that is used to transport materials from one city to another along a river, which is different again from a mammoth tanker which travels from one continent to the other. So the question was, can you see a relationship between that little boat in the bathtub and that immense mammoth tanker on the oceans if there is no mammoth tanker as yet? So what if you have the little boat in the bathtub, if you have the rowing boat on the lake, if you have the barge on the river, but there is no larger ship as yet? So that's where something came in which is called model theory, which later led to the notion of dimensional analysis, for the very simple reason that if you have a model and you try to make it larger, then you need to account for some differences. So for example, you try to make a model boat which you can trail in a water tank, so essentially the little boat in the bathtub, but you want to use that little model so that you can design a better mammoth tanker. But that mammoth tanker hasn't been built yet. Nobody ever conceived of it. Nobody knows how large you can make a boat. So then there are a couple principles that you're dealing with, which are all these alchemical principles of the state, the process, the transformation, and the integration, which you can then describe in this notion of system theory. So you have the state, the change, the transformation, the integration. And you can use the model of system theory to describe that. And how that was discovered is essentially what we are now looking into. Once you have this notion of the little boat and you want to make it bigger, then you need to realize what will change when you make the boat bigger. So the wood will be bigger, the volume of the ship will be bigger, the length of the ship will be bigger. But the water will not get bigger. So that led to a notion of scalability. If you make things larger, what will scale up and what will not? You can scale up the boat, but you cannot scale up the water, you cannot scale up the wind, you cannot scale up the raindrops. So if you have a model boat which is 1/10 of the size of the ship that you will be designing, then the raindrops will not be 10 times. The wind will not be 10 times as strong. The water waves on the oceans will not be 10 times as high. They will still be the same. But nevertheless, you can see that there will be a relationship between that and scaling theory. Essentially, they just mapped that out. What will change, what will not. Can we model a little boat on little waves in a puddle? Yes, we can. Can that model what happens with big waves on the ocean? Yes, it can, because if you make the waves in the bathtub a bit larger, they might be the length of the boat in the bathtub, but in the same way there might be waves of the length of the mammoth tanker on the ocean. So those things are scalable. This, by the way, is a very general principle. You can apply that to everything. Once you start to think in this way, for example, this is also used in the design of bridges. If you try to design and build a steel bridge, in your mind at some point you must ask the question, what if this bridge were made of cheese and the temperature goes up? Then what you cannot see or imagine easily with the steel bridge, once you change your mind and say, well, just imagine that this would be a bridge made out of cheese, then you can sort of imagine how with the increase of temperature this whole bridge will turn into a raclette. So there are ways of connecting what happens to one scale to the other. And so in this scaling theory, they put all of that together, and out of that came a fundamental new insight, which is called dimensional analysis, which was that if you look at all these elements, all these as they are called parameters of this model building, then suddenly you can see that the length of the boat, the volume of the boat, the weight of the boat, the viscosity of the water, the surface tension of the water, the relative density of the water versus the relative density of the wood of the ship, and so on. You can put all of that together. It's basically like a shopping list of everything that you need to build a boat in that situation. But then you find out that, and that's the power of this whole concept of dimensional analysis, and very fundamental to all kind of understanding, that once you have this shopping list of all the ingredients that you must account for in your model, then you see that all of these bits and pieces in your model list can be described in terms of mass, time, and energy. That would be called kilogram, meters, and seconds. Essentially, meters would be the measure for space, time, seconds would be the measurement of time, and kilograms would be the measurement of energy. So we've gotten way beyond that now, and that was also addressed in the story of alchemy, that essentially space is three-dimensional, time is two-dimensional, energy is one-dimensional, and there's also the information level zero-dimensional. But in model theory, in dimensional analysis, everything on the shopping list is pulled back to the formulation of how many meters are in there, how many seconds are in there, how many kilograms are in there. So if you have a bit of wood, then it will have a length, it will have a width, it will have a height. So you have meters and meters and meters, so you have meters cubed. If you have it in motion, then time will come in. If the motion changes, then the time change over time will come in, time squared. And if the mass is fixed, the kilograms will come in. If it is fluid, the mass will change, and you will have kilogram changes. So all of that was listed in this shopping list for making that model. And then Henry Langhaar had a wonderful idea to see that you could actually manipulate these meters, seconds, and kilograms values of all these parameters, multiply them in a tricky way, and needing to come out to the number one. If you wanted to scale it, it needed to end up at one. And it is a description in itself how that worked. Actually, it is a very simple trick. You need to know which of the parameters you have in your model. You write them down in meters per second square times kilogram, or whatever the unit is. You calculate them all out into a dimensionless number, and out of that comes what's called a critical number, and that critical number will determine where the model will no longer be valid. That critical number specifies how change will need to be accounted for in that model. So when they started to do that for building the ships, out came the number of Mach, the number of Reynolds, the number of Struhal. There's a whole series of so-called dimensionless numbers, all of which are characteristic for a change of state from one thing to another. For example, if you think of building a water dam, then the water dam will block the flow of the water. You will have the lake on one side, you will have the river on the other side, and in between you will have the hole in the dam. But the hole in the dam is so small with respect to this whole lake that by the immense water pressure which has been built up in a dam, the water that comes out through that hole shoots out sort of straight. And then when it shoots out at some point in that other environment, there is no counter pressure, so the water will sort of topple over itself. From shooting water, it will into the flow of the river. And so you can see this also when you have a water hose and you clean the street. You can point the water hose on the street and you say that there's a like a pancake area where the water is flat and straight and shooting. Then there is this rim of the turbulent zone where the shooting water turns into flowing water, and after that you have the flowing water. So this model of the dimensional analysis made it possible to understand that there will be that transition zone between the shooting water and the flowing water. So in a way you could predict where the edges of the reality would be when you make a model. So essentially, by that approach, all of these dimensionless numbers, which are seen in very many different forms in physics and can be described in a very simple form in mathematics, they correspond with all these strange areas in society which we call taboo. And so all of the taboo zones are areas where the knowledge that we have no longer applies and it needs to transform into something else. So with this dimensional analysis theory, it is possible to see, predict, where these taboo zones will be. This actually is something which they still need to incorporate into politics and sociology, and also in ecology and economy, because that is where society at the moment has all of its crashes. All of the revolutions and all of the crashes in nature and all of the economic crashes and all of the religious wars, they're based only on this principle of the dimensionless number of, let's call it, the taboo zone, where things change from one state to the other. So this notion of the scalability of models combined with this notion of the dimensionless number of the criticality of any model can then be included in this principle of system theory. And so then we can see that in system theory we can use the language of radio diagrams, and the radio diagram language is so specific, so precise, that all of the computers are designed by that, all of the radar systems are designed by that. The computers actually calculate how the aeroplanes fly, the tracking system of the postal system is based on that. Anywhere where you see the relationship between a state, a process, a transformation, and you need to have the integration of that, you can use this system theory. And as the previous exploration already addressed, this system theory actually describes exactly the same as alchemy, but this previous story described that alchemy is actually also what happens within our body. So that means that when we combine system theory with alchemy, we can see that system theory does not only apply to the things that we see around us, the physical reality, but also, as alchemy presented, to what happens within us. How the cells within our body are able to use information. As a result of that, they are able to transform the nuclear energy reactions within the cell cores. As a result, they are able to change the chemical process of the cell activity and interactivity, the relationship between the cells. And out of that comes, say, the printout of the structure of the body in a material form. So that's also why I'm so enthusiastic about system theory. And that's also why I was so happy when I ran into that in my engineering program, where first we were building bridges, and then we needed to think about bridges made of cheese, and then we had to think about boats small and large, and what you need to take into account to understand where things can and will go wrong. And then suddenly there was this model of system theory as designed by Ludwig von Bertalanffy, which could be applied for the design of bridges, the design of harbors, the design of cranes, the design of traffic flow on the road, the describe of chemical reactions anywhere. And evidently the language which it contains already was directly connected to everything electromagnetic and the radio circuits, the radio diagrams, computer design, and so on. So suddenly there is this one very simple practical tool of system theory which makes use of the language of radio design, which actually incorporates within it all of this understanding of alchemy, and which can be applied to anything that we see and anything we can conceive of, including ourselves. So that is what I then set out to do later. After I had concluded my engineering school, I realized that I had come into this understanding of system theory and the practical counterpart of it called cybernetics because I had been looking at how the universe is formed. And so in looking at how the universe is formed, I could see that basically one point unfolded itself to form the universe as a whole, so from a point to a line to a plane to a volume, which can be very easily described by a vortex. Then I discovered that you can describe that in the language of system theory, which I had already realized is a different form of what alchemists described. So afterwards, I went into the British Library to see who else knew this. And then I discovered that these principles of what I call the four-dimensional logic of crossing a boundary or creating a boundary, which is the essence of alchemy, which is the essence of system theory, is known worldwide. It has been known all the time. So anywhere where you see that there are four elements, the alchemical four elements, in a religion or in a social structure or in a taboo system or in the mythologies of the culture or in a transactional, interactional coding for doing business or ousting people out of society, you can replace all of that by the Swiss pocket knife of system theory, with the understanding that you're actually doing alchemy, with the realization that you're actually using radio diagrams to do that, which means that you are doing a very precise mathematical calculation. And just to show how neat all of that is, I always used the model of the radio diagram. The radio diagram, as I mentioned before, is basically, say, metal wire with some electronic pieces in it. So you'll have a switch, you'll have a resistor, you'll have a coil, and you have a condenser. And when you put them around in a loop, that loop, by the way, is drawn as a square, which totally corresponds with this notion of the alchemist, of the square circle. And then you can see that in these four loops, there is a relationship between the switch and the resistor. They are, in a mathematical formulation, dual of each other. Dual, D-U-A-L, from the word dualis in Greek. That means that they're joint, they're complements, they are opposites, they're two aspects of the same thing. There you can see that for the resistor and the switch, it is about the relationship between energy and information. And in the same way, the relationship between the coil and the capacitor, or the condenser, is also dual. So the equation for the capacitor and the equation for the coil are exactly the same, but you need to switch space and time. Once you understand that, you can see that space and time are directly connected, information and energy are directly connected, but all of these four components are connected in one circuit, which showed to me that space, time, energy and consciousness are connected, and that helped me to understand how cells work with everything. But that also shows that once you see how this all connects, then in system theory you can actually extend the notion of system theory that you're not just working with the capacitor, with the attenuator, with the transformer and with the switch, which in the electronic diagram would be the condenser, the coil, the resistor and the switch, but you're actually dealing with a storage, which is space. You're actually dealing with attenuation in time, so that's the dimension of time. You're actually dealing with the transformation of energy, so you're dealing with energy, and you're connecting to the switch of on-off, which is a change of state of information. So then you can see, and that really helped me a lot, that space, time, energy, and consciousness are actually three-dimensional, two-dimensional, one-dimensional, and zero-dimensional aspects of the same, let's call it the radio circuit. And that is why system theory, in all of its very many shapes, is so practical, because the model is very simple. It is, let's call it the radio diagram, which in psychology or sociology would be called a SORC diagram. So the system, the operation, the response, and the programming, or the conditioning. So in so many shapes and forms you can recognize the same principle. And so often people pretend that they discovered something new, why they just used system theory and dressed it up in a different form. Yes, then it helps to look beyond the form and the dress-ups, which people tend to do because they want to have money for something. I call that a survival gimmick. So look beyond the survival gimmick into what's going on, and you will recognize that at the basis there is system theory, which is alchemy, which is mathematics, which can be modeled in the radio diagrams. So that then is essentially the story of system theory, that we now have one model which is very simple, very direct, very straightforward, basically like a Swiss pocket knife, which was created by Ludwig von Bertalanffy, because he realized that in the system of differential equations, the mathematics which was already existing could now be used to describe the more complex relationships as we see in biology. And for me that came back to the understanding, but yes, but what we are dealing with is how we can cross a boundary, or how we can create or eliminate a boundary. So that for me came together later as this notion of boundary transformation, which is the universal principle of creation. There is nothing else. Everything comes out of that. Because at the level of phase space, you will need to have a kind of phase coherence, which we call energy, which needs to cohere in itself as a traveling wave, which we call time. And it can then cohere within itself yet again in a standing wave, which we call space. So with system theory, we then have a language to address all of that. And as I mentioned, it has become so well known, even though people don't recognize it anymore, because of the practical applications of it. When it is described as a theory, it is called system theory. As soon as it's called put in practice, it is called cybernetics. Compared to when it is flowing through cables, it's called electricity. Electricity flows through the cables. When it's outside of the cables, it's called magnetism. Again, it's a kind of relationship between the practice and the theory. So the theory is called system theory, the practice is called cybernetics. And it's called cybernetics because it was realized that this approach is used on ships. When you have a ship and you want to go to the other side of the river, you can see the tree that you're aiming for. Let's use a lake instead of a river to start with. You want to go to the other side of the lake, then you will see that you can aim the bow of the ship towards the tree, and if the ship starts to point anywhere else, then you put your rudder in the opposite direction and you put it back so that the ship points at the tree again. The trick is that in cybernetics, when you correct things, you do the opposite. And that's also why cybernetics has been called the one part of science where mistakes are really appreciated, because you need the mistake to correct it. So where a lot of religions and a lot of social systems have all these moralities about how you should things, do things, and the tables of what you should not do, They don't have a self-corrective thing. So system theory changes all that. Cybernetics shows how to do it. It doesn't matter that things go wrong. Things will go wrong. So don't blame people. Don't go with guilt and shame and all these other things. But just realize that when you sin, which is an old archery term of not hitting the mark, sinning is to miss the mark, then if you sin, if the ship is not pointing at the tree anymore, then use the rudder. Steer it back to where you need to be. So you need to do something within yourself, which might seem to be opposite of what's going on, but as a result you can reconnect the process of what you're doing it in the process of what's going on in the environment around you. So by changing the rudder, your connection with the ship, then you can change the relationship between the ship and the water and the wind and the sails. Evidently, once you have that picture of how it works on the lake, you can see that on a gently flowing river, you need to do the same, but the river will put you in one direction and you will need to steer in the other direction quite consistently. And that's where you then realize that the flow of the river will need to sort of balance out against the speed of the boat, which you get from the sails, from the rowing, or from the engine. So then you can start to see how it's not just about steering the ship, but also by using the throttle on the sail or on the rowers or on the engine. So with system theory, you can actually go into all levels of complexity of the system and set them right. So there is a very fundamental principle in this, because of course once you understand this, and from system theory you understand that this applies to hydraulic systems of the rain on the land, forming rivers, forming lakes, going back to the oceans, but it also works to the cargo of the ship being hoisted out by the cranes. It also works on the electron flow in the computer between the memories and the chip. So once you understand it's all the same principles, then everything really starts to fall in place, because your mind can switch to looking for that underlying principle. And that's also why I like system theory so much, and why I like the conferences on system theory so much, because all of these people there were looking at very many different things by the same method, and specifically by a method in which they could not only describe states and changes and transformations and integrations, but also describe that in very many different aspects of our life and our environment. And that's why I think it would be really helpful if everybody knew system theory. It is something that you can learn in an afternoon or less. Because when everybody thinks in system theory terms, and then they operate themselves as cybernetic units, then of course we will be able to have a totally different society, which is why I then call that planting paradise, because everybody will be a creator in creation. Everybody will know that it is not about sinning, but about correcting it. The principle of self-correction are built into ourselves, which is why I created that principle of integral healthcare, and described that as a science of life. So that would be the system theory level of description, and the cybernetics application of it is then in this project of planting paradise with humanity on the one side, integral healthcare on the other side, and all of it is connected by this one simple straightforward model. So I'd like to leave it at this for now. So that rounds off this brief introduction to system theory, in which I presented that for me system theory is the same as describing how a boundary can be formed, but also how boundary can be crossed. That essentially is a logic which you can describe in mathematics, which you can connect to the physics, and then out comes this theory of system theory, which is alchemy, with a mathematical notation and a graphic representation in the form of the radio diagrams. I'll just close it off for now. Come back to you to evaluate.